Nearly a half century ago, a scientific administrator on a business trip to New York was found dead from an apparent suicide leap from his hotel window. Mystery has shrouded his death, and in 1975, a government probe came to the conclusion that Frank R. Olson died after being slipped LSD without his knowledge by the CIA. Since then, the family have tirelessly tried to extract the truth as to why their father, Frank Olson, died. We have Eric Olson on the line, his son, and his brother from Fort Detrick, Maryland. And welcome to the International Connection.
Thank you.
Eric, and what's your brother's name?
My brother's name is Nils.
Hi, Nils. I'm here with Daniel Becheret, my co-host.
Good morning.
This story has spanned almost a half a century, as I noted in the opening, and just this year, did your family finally give up on trying to find the truth in this situation?
No, we did not give up. We feel we did find the truth. Well, we decided this year that it was finally time to rebury my father's remains, and which had been out of the ground for 8 years in connection with a forensic investigation that began in 1994. So we had a press conference to describe the results of our long investigation. We did that on August 8th, and then the following day we reburied the remains of our father.
So let's go back then almost 50 years to the incident that occurred in New York City. And can you first describe what your family was told about what occurred there? And tell us a little bit about what your father's job was and where he worked and what he did.
Well, my father was a scientific administrator and scientist at what was then called Camp Dietrich. He had come there during the Second World War in 1943 when Dietrich was first established as the United States Center for Bacteriological Warfare Research. And he held a number of positions, and in 1950, a sort of super secret subdivision of Dietrich was established called Special Operations, and he was for a while a director of that division. And in any case, was involved with it between 1950 when it was established and 1953 when he died. As to what we were told when he died, that's a very, very short story. We were simply told early on the morning of November 28th that he had had an accident and that he had fallen or jumped out the window of a hotel in New York City and had died. That's kind of the beginning, the middle, and the end of what we were told.
And what were the ages of the family? How old were you, your brothers, sisters, and so on?
I was 9 years old at the time. My sister was 7, my brother was 5, and my mother at that time was 38. My father was 43.
Your mother was told this news, and she told the family, and what transpired after that?
Well, one of the things that transpired was we were immediately assured that we would receive government compensation, and this took only 3 days to arrange, which you might imagine is something like a record in the annals of bureaucratic history. You know, of course, we weren't aware at the time, but in hindsight, one can see that this showed the kind of urgency that was attached to this affair, and the need to make sure that we felt, in some sense, taken care of, so that a minimum of questions would be raised about what exactly happened. At least we wouldn't be inspired to do so from anxiety about the economic situation.
When did the questions start coming up? When did your family start to raise queries about your father's death?
Well, it's hard to say exactly. I mean, it kind of began from the beginning in a way. I mean, because the sparsity of information we were given, you know, wasn't satisfying for very long. Though the sense of trauma around this was so intense that operated to kind of create a barrier to raising questions. And that was combined with a sense of taboo around this, coming from the fact that most of the family's closest friends were associated with this research installation at Dietrich. And many of them knew various parts of the story, and quite a few of them knew that at least the story that we were being told was far from the whole story. In the years that followed, my brother and sister and I all had problems with giving an account of what had happened to our father. Fortunately, many of the people in the town didn't ask because this became well enough known that other kids and so on knew not to ask. And there was some sense of that this was a suicide, but slightly more unspeakable than a normal suicide, and with some sense of taboo around it. So we were not asked very often what happened, but we were asked sometimes, and we all kind of mumbled awkwardly and said something like our father had suffered from a fatal nervous breakdown or something to that effect. But this became more of a problem, actually, when we began to leave this town and go to college. And I think for all of us, my brother and sister and I, it caused a kind of crisis later on when we would be asked questions and realize that we knew actually nothing and couldn't speak for more than 30 seconds without, you know, entering an abyss.
I have Daniel Bichard with me, who has a question for you.
You released on August the 8th a family statement regarding what you call the murder of Frank Olson. And this, of course, is available online to those people who wish to, I guess, see it. And I'm assuming this is available at www.frankolsonproject.org. Is that correct?
It will be. It should be.
At the beginning, very quickly, you briefly describe three, I guess you call them headlines, as to what the conclusions of what all this research, all this family research has gone into. Could you describe those?
Yeah, we tried to give a sense in advance in this statement. It's about 23 pages long. We wanted to give a sense of where we were going with this. And the three points we made were, first, that the death of Frank Olson on November 28, 1953 was a murder, not a suicide. Second, that this is not an LSD drug experiment story as it was represented in 1975. It's a biological warfare story. Frank Olson did not die because he was an experimental guinea pig who experienced a bad trip. He died because of concern that he would divulge information concerning a highly classified CIA interrogation program called Artichoke in the early 1950s and concerning the use of biological weapons by the United States in the Korean War. And third, the truth concerning the death of Frank Olson was concealed from the Olson family as well as from the public in 1953. In 1975, a cover story regarding Frank Olson's death was disseminated. At the same time, a renewed cover-up of the truth concerning this story was being carried out at the highest levels of government, including the White House. The new cover-up involved the participation of persons serving in the current administration. I might also mention right now that one of the kind of happy coincidences that occurred in connection with our press conference and the reburial was that there was a premiere of a new documentary on this story that has been made over the course of the last 2 years by a German company, and which premiered on August 12th in Germany. And this is available in an English international version. We don't yet know if or when it will be shown in the United States or Canada. The company is trying to make arrangements to have it shown elsewhere. And it's a spectacularly good film, but that'll help you kind of fill in the broad outlines as well as many of the details of this story as it stands now.
Now, in 1975, this story was resurrected, and it was resurrected by whom? Did the government bring this up for some reason that they had, or was this at the family's behest that this investigation was done?
No, not at all. It was entirely a governmental intervention, but a very strange one. As you may recall, in 1975 there was a commission called the Rockefeller Commission that had been set up by Gerald Ford when he took over from Nixon, and as part of the, you know, overall re-legitimation of the American government after Watergate, Gerald Ford enfranchised this commission to look into domestic wrongdoings of the CIA, which basically involved things like wiretapping and eavesdropping on citizens. But somehow, in connection with the investigation that led to their report, the committee happened upon a file that I'm now convinced is a cover file, but nevertheless a file concerning our father, Frank Olson. And they published in their report that was issued on July the 11th, 1975, the report included two paragraphs dealing with the suicide, as they called it, of an Army scientist. And the term Army scientist was the only identification given to this person. His name was not revealed. None of the details about the situation in which he had been drugged, allegedly drugged by the CIA, were revealed. and no details about the way he died were revealed. It was just simply alleged that this is what had happened. He had been at a meeting sponsored by the CIA, had been unwittingly drugged with LSD, and then plunged to his death a week later from a hotel window in New York City. And we heard about this not because we were contacted by the Rockefeller Commission or the White House or the CIA. We read about it in a newspaper report in the Washington Post that was published as a front page story July 11th, 1975. And the title of that article was very ironic. It was called Suicide Revealed. And as I've sometimes said, that title is doubly ironic because it turns out it wasn't a suicide, but it also wasn't revealed. The article doesn't mention the name of this person. Our attention was called to this article by a friend, and once we saw it, the coincidences between the few facts that were disclosed in this article and what we knew about my father's death were so striking that we immediately concluded that this must be my father. This happened in 1953. It occurred in New York. It occurred there was a fall from a hotel window, and so on and so forth. So we decided this must be Frank Olson, and were able to get this confirmed by my father's old boss. And then later on in July, we held a press conference where we revealed that this was indeed Frank Olson. That's what we wanted to do again this summer, was to have a press conference in which we would kind of update this story a quarter of a century later. And once we held the press conference in 1975, within something like 10 days, we were sitting in the Oval Office of the White House. We were immediately invited to come to the White House to receive what was described as an apology on behalf of the American people for this whole incident. And a few days after that, we were invited to the CIA, where we got a stack of documents directly from the hand of William Colby at a luncheon we had with him when he was director in the director's office in the seventh floor of the building in Langley. And that really set in motion the next long, long period of latency in this story, because those documents, I began to go through them and was completely mystified by them, actually, and eventually came to the conclusion that this was a false file and an extremely misleading account of what had happened.
Does it seem odd to you that the subject was even broached by the government? Have you thought about that, why they brought up this story that, for all intents and purposes, had been totally forgotten by almost everybody except the immediate family?
I think that is a bit strange, but it's actually not too hard to understand the dynamic that in all probability led that to occur. William Colby, when he was director of the CIA, and the CIA was under, many forms of attack, decided that it was important to make some kind of clean breast of things, and directed that all files referring to indictable criminal activity on the part of the CIA should be gathered in one place. This, of course, earned him the ire of many in the agency. A great many files were gathered together in one place at the CIA in his office. These became known as the family jewels, and apparently the Olson file was one among these. And one can only surmise at this point that once that file was brought to him, there must have been some sort of discussion as to whether this would be revealed or not and included among the elements or the items given to the Rockefeller Commission. And I suspect that what happened was it was a compromise reach where the file was released under the agreement that the name would not be included. So this led to the particularly bizarre situation in which the story was told, but we were not notified. And as we sometimes said, this created a situation that was like an MIA who is found decades later after his death, but the family is never notified. And this was one of the most bizarre and maddening but also I think revealing aspects of this whole 1975 period.
After 1976, after your family had received financial statements from Congress, you signed an agreement saying that all your claims against the U.S. government in the death of Frank Olson were settled. Why was this signed at that time in 1976?
Yeah, well, it's painful to recall this whole period, but basically what happened was that you know, we had demanded a number of things beginning at the press conference that we held, and you know, one of them was full disclosure of the whole story concerning Frank Olson and what had happened to him. Another was some sort of assurance that this kind of experimentation, as we thought was had been involved, would not occur again. And third, some sort of compensation for this death and the long period of cover-up. And once we got the files from Colby, that part of our demand was in some sense satisfied. It took actually years before we dug through these files carefully enough to realize that they made no sense, but nevertheless at the moment in a formal sense that demand had been responded to. And then the White House told us, we were dealing with White House attorneys at the time, and they assured us that, you know, they wanted us to be fully compensated for this whole affair, and together with the Labor Department, the Justice Department, and the CIA came up with a figure that they thought was a fair amount and told us that we were unlikely to be successful if we went to court because the law was really not on our side. You get into something called the Federal Tort Claims Act, which is quite difficult, and so on. So they suggested that what needed to happen was a private bill in Congress that would compensate us. We weren't really sure, and our attorneys, you know, were somewhat divided about whether that was the right course to follow, but the White House assured us that we had the support of Congress and so on, so, and the figure that they came up with sounded, you know, reasonable. It was $1.25 million at the time. It turned out that the support in Congress, majority support, was really not the issue. The support had to be unanimous. It turned out, and we didn't know this at the time, that a private bill can only be enacted to compensate an individual or a family or a small group if it's unanimous. And it turned out there was a congressman, kind of a right-wing maniac from Orange County, California, who decided to oppose this. So on one very bad day, the amount was slashed by $500,000, and we ended up getting $750,000, which was very unsatisfying in terms of the way this all occurred. As my mother said at the time, if you compromise an apology, you don't have an apology. And, you know, that was really the least of it, because as time wore on, it became clear that the story we had been given, you know, made no sense either.
Can you give us the name of that right-wing maniac?
His name was John Russolo.
Now, you were dealing with some pretty high-power people, or people who would be even more high-power later on. We're talking about the recently installed in 1976 and briefly installed CIA director George Herbert Walker Bush.
Right.
And who would later become vice president, then president, now father of the current president.
Right.
So did you have any dealings with CIA director or then CIA director Bush?
Well, the dealing that we had that was direct was with Colby. When Colby was replaced and Bush 41, as he's known, came in, we never met with him. The only involvement he had was a letter of support for the full amount of this compensation that he wrote to Congress to endorse the settlement from the standpoint of the CIA.
But he probably might have known that the right-wing maniac would come in and cut it in half. Right?
I don't know. I wouldn't say that for sure, because money was not the issue with them. I mean, the CIA, I think, was quite genuine. They would have been okay if it had been even more money, because for them, the issue wasn't money. The issue was getting this over with and making sure that we didn't get deeper into what the story actually was.
Now, that's the interesting part with what the story is about. Daniel, go ahead.
Now, after that, you write here in your release that the fell or jumped scenario at the window never really made sense. And what, briefly, if you could explain, what is this fell or jumped scenario at the window, and what exactly happened that the CIA or that the government released in 1975? What was the story surrounding what they believe was Frank R. Olson's death? And what, to you and your family, never really made sense with regards to the story that the government put forward?
Well, the story involving the actual death remained unchanged between 1953 and 1975, though this was not immediately apparent in 1975 because there was such a hullabaloo around this LSD and the idea of the CIA involved with LSD and illegally drugging, unwittingly drugging people and so on, that the matter of, well, okay, fine, but how did this drugging lead to the death and what exactly happened in that hotel room? This was the question that had always haunted me, and actually no light at all was shed on that. But that kind of receded for the moment, except that right after we held our press conference in July 75, the news came out in June, the press conference was in July, we were contacted by someone named Armin Pastore, who had been the night manager at the hotel in New York, then called the Statler Hotel, now called the Hotel Pennsylvania. It's right across from Penn Station on 7th Avenue. We were contacted by Armin Pastore, who wrote to us a very touching letter that is on the, available on the website, and said that he had been on duty the night that my father had died and that he had been called by the bellboy out to the street when someone had fallen, and that our father had died in Pastore's arms. And we later went to see him, and he told us much more about what had happened that night than we had ever known before. And what he emphasized was that, you know, when my father fell to the ground, he wasn't dead. He was staring, you know, he was lying on his back on the street and looking up into Pastore's arms and trying to say something, and then died literally in Pastore's arms, at which point, after the ambulance came to take my father away, Pastore went into the hotel room, or into the hotel lobby, to talk to the switchboard operator to see whether any calls had been made from the room. And she said, yes, there was one. And he said, really, what was the content of the call? And the switchboard operator, in fact, had overheard the call and said that it consisted only of two sentences. The caller from the room said, well, he's gone. And the guy on the other end said, that's too bad. And then they both hung up. Well, hearing that was extremely alarming, because it's hard to interpret that very brief conversation in any other way than that a message was being sent that the mission had been accomplished, and that was it. It certainly, there was no sense of grief, no sense of shock. And the other thing that Pastore said was that when he and the police went up to the room, he figured out which room this fall had occurred from, and they went up to the room, and when they entered the room, they weren't certain whether there was going to be anybody in there or not, because nobody had called down. But in fact, there was a guy sitting on the toilet in his underwear. And that turns out to be Robert Lashbrook, who's still alive, who was the CIA escort who was sleeping in the same room as my father and who was charged with keeping track of him, in other words, acting as a kind of guardian during those days in New York. So these details were obviously not reassuring, and kind of lit a fire that continued to grow over many years, and this fueled the impulse to an investigation which we actively pursued during the past decade.
One of the other stories that comes up here, maybe perhaps the reason why your father would have been murdered, was that he had information about bacteriological warfare being used in the Korean War. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, I mean, you really have to drop back a little bit, because one of the things that it's important to note in the revelations, in 1975 was that no details about my father's employment at all were given. He was simply identified as an Army scientist, end of story. It turns out that he had been involved with this so-called Special Operations Division, and Special Operations was set up at Dietrich in 1950, really essentially as an off-campus CIA lab. It was physically at Dietrich, but organizationally it was really part of the CIA, and most, if not all, of the funding came from the CIA, and it arose from a document that was written in 1949 by Ira Baldwin, who was the man who essentially founded Fort Dietrich and who was the scientist who had brought my father there. And this document by Baldwin sounds very contemporary if you read it now, because it remarks upon the strong connection between biological warfare, covert operations, and terrorism, and recommends that a special unit be set up to investigate this. And that became Special Operations, and for reasons that are obvious, the CIA took a great interest in this. And this unit began doing all manner of things sort of in that space of covert operations, terrorism, biological warfare, and this came to include a lot of things, including, you know, assassination, materials research, experiments over human populations, and drug and interrogation research using chemicals and other methods. And none of this was known in 1975. And obviously, once you know some of this, the scenario as it was portrayed then, well, this was just an army scientist who was used as a guinea pig, and unfortunately he reacted badly, but we did our best to take care of him. But again, you know, God knows we tried our best, but when we weren't looking, he jumped out the window. That's essentially the story as it was told in 75. I call that the fairy tale. It sort of stands up a little bit if you know nothing about the context. Once you do know something about the context, I think of it as the emperor's new clothes. I mean, it's basically stripped naked, and there's sort of not much there to hold on to.